June is here, which means it's finally time to reach for your summer wardrobe. And if you're trying to look good without overheating, Quince is your best bet. Their summer collection has all the warm weather staples, breathable linen, washable silk, and soft organic cotton. I now own their 100% linen pants in more colors than I'd like to admit. And the best part is that you get all that quality without the luxury markup. Everything at Quince is priced 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Quince works directly with ethical factories and cuts out the middlemen, so you're paying for quality, not brand markup. And it's not just clothing. Quince has become a destination for elevated essentials across the home, from kitchen to bedding, making it easy to bring a more premium feel into everyday life. Elevate your summer wardrobe. Go to quince.com/campus for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. Now available in Canada too. That's quince.com/campus for free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/campus.
Summer routines live or die by how easy they are. And honestly, if something takes too much effort, I'm out. That's why Grunes is my go-to. It's one daily pack of gummies covering my greens, vitamins, and minerals. Plus, it has 6 grams of prebiotic fiber, which is more than 2 cups of broccoli. No mixing powders, no giant pills, no hassle. Just rip open the pack and I'm done. They taste good and it makes it easy to stay on top of my health, even when life gets busy. Save up to 52% off with code PODCAST at Grunes.co. That's code PODCAST at GRUNS.co.
The lid is off, the season is on. Basketball is back, and that's big news for the fans from coast to coast. 12,000 are out of
Madison Square Garden, March 1950. The air is hazy with cigarette smoke. Almost 19,000 fans fill the arena, shoulder to shoulder. It's the NCAA championship game. And this year's matchup feels different. One team stands on the edge of making history. The City College of New York, or CCNY. They've already won the NIT tournament. Now they're one win away from something no team has ever done, landing both the NIT and NCAA championships in the same season. Of all the teams in college basketball, no one expected CCNY to be here. These were poor kids from working class neighborhoods. At a time when most college teams were entirely white and the NBA hadn't even integrated, CCNY's starting lineup featured 2 black players and 3 Jewish players. The locker room is tense. The players know exactly what's at stake. And then the door swings open and in walks Jackie Robinson.
Jackie Robinson had started playing for the Dodgers just a few years before, had broken the color line, and was really a symbol of racial progress.
Jackie Robinson wasn't just a great athlete. He was a barrier breaker, someone whose achievements reached far beyond sports.
The fact that he came, I think, further concretized in the minds of the players the idea that they were really something special and that this was really a special game.
In that moment, City College stood at the very top of the basketball world. The players were heroes. The city was bursting with pride. That feeling wouldn't last long. Soon, news broke that their beloved team was entangled in a web of mobsters and corruption. And that triumphant team would become forever tied to one of college basketball's darkest chapters. I'm Margot Gray. This week on Campus Files, the triumph and downfall of the City College Beavers.
The City College of New York was founded in the 19th century and continues to be one of the great institutions in the city of New York.
That's Matthew Goodman, author of The City Game, Triumph, Scandal, and a Legendary Basketball Team. His father attended City College of New York, or CCNY, so he grew up hearing about the school and its mission.
Which is to take very bright New York City high school students who, for one reason or another, are kept out of other schools and provide them free of charge an education equal to perhaps any other academic institution in the United States.
For decades, that group was made up mostly of Jewish students who still face quotas at elite universities. In the first half of the 20th century, by some estimates, more than 80% of CCNY's student body was Jewish. The joke around town was that CCNY stood for Circumcised Citizens of New York. City College was also home to a growing number of Black students. As one author put it, the campus was filled with the sons of immigrants and the grandsons of slaves. But access didn't mean lowered standards. Admission was super competitive, and the school held itself to the highest expectations. You could even see that in the campus architecture, built in the collegiate Gothic style.
Buildings with great gargoyles on them, you know, stone-clad buildings rising high to the sky. And I would venture to say for most of the poor and working class Jewish immigrants or children of immigrants who arrived at the gates of City College for their first day of school, it must have been like being transported to across the ocean to Cambridge or to Oxford. They would never have seen a place like this.
The intellectual energy on campus was palpable. In the cafeteria, you could often hear students arguing about topics like Trotskyism and Stalinism over lunch.
City College was known widely as Harvard on the Hudson, a school known for its academics, not a school known for its sports teams. In fact, it was sort of had kind of legendarily terrible sports teams.
There was one exception, the basketball team, the Beavers. In the 1940s, they were the pride of the school.
My father, he was a big sports fan. I was a sports fan. And over the years, I would hear about this kind of legendary basketball team.
To understand how big the basketball team was at CCNY, you first have to understand how big college basketball was in New York City at the time.
New York City was the national center of college basketball. Today, that's sort of unthinkable. You know, college basketball is really not one of the big sports in New York today. You have to go to places like Kentucky or places like Indiana or North Carolina to find those kind of college basketball hotbeds the way that New York used to be.
New York was home to five nationally ranked teams. These teams actually rivaled the popularity of the Yankees and the Brooklyn Dodgers, and they played many of their games at Madison Square Garden.
At New York's Madison Square Garden, a City College quintet faces five fast and fancy web feet from the University of Oregon. It's the opening contest.
The thing that people remember about the games at Madison Square Garden was the smoke, the cigarette smoke. Everybody smoked.
One sports writer said that watching a game from the upper levels of MSG was like trying to see the ground from an airplane through the clouds. The smoke was so thick that to prepare for it, one out-of-state coach actually set off smoke bombs in his own gym during practice. But CCNY fans didn't care about the haze. They came to see their Beavers play, and the team delivered, thanks in large part to one man, head coach Nat Holman.
Nat Holman might well have been the first celebrity coach in college basketball. He was known by people who were not necessarily basketball fans.
Nat Holman called himself Mr. Basketball. Boastful, sure, but he wasn't wrong. When he played for the original Celtics, he was considered one of the best players of his generation. Converse even wanted him to be the face of their new sneaker. When he declined, they turned to another professional player, someone whose name you might recognize, Chuck Taylor.
Nat Holman, he had grown up in New York, had learned the game in the settlement houses of the Lower East Side, where they had very low ceilings, and so you couldn't have high arching shots and so forth. That was where he learned the kind of motion offense that he brought to City College. The players were constantly in motion at all times, and it was really kind of a beautiful game to watch.
Holman had been coaching at CCNY for 30 years, and he had an impressive record of 359 wins. But despite the success, the team had never come close to winning a national championship in either of the major tournaments, the NIT or the NCAA. There was hope that might change during the 1949-1950 season. Holman and his assistant coach had recruited an all-star lineup. It was a team that looked nothing like the other premier programs around the country.
Every single member of the 15 players on that team were either Jewish or African-American, every single one of them.
The Jewish players weren't unusual for the time. In fact, in the first half of the 20th century, basketball was often called a Jewish sport. But a team that included Black basketball players was highly unusual. At the time, only about 10% of college basketball programs recruited Black players. This was only 2 years after Jackie Robinson broke baseball's color barrier, and still 4 years before the Supreme Court would rule on Brown v. Board of Education.
The starting five comprised three Jewish players and two African-American players. The coach of the team, Nat Holman, was Jewish, as was his assistant coach.
Both coaches knew they had something special that season, a team unlike any they'd coached before. But making the postseason tournaments was far from guaranteed. Unlike today, teams didn't automatically qualify based on their record. It was invite-only, hand-selected by committee. And the Beavers knew the deal. If they had any hope of getting in, they'd have to beat every other New York team that season.
They usually reserved one slot for the winner of the so-called Subway Conference, which didn't really exist. It was an imaginary idea, but whatever local New York team had the best record would be given a slot. And the CCNY was the leader of the Subway Conference that year, and so they received their invitation to the National Invitation Tournament.
CCNY had barely made the cut. They were the last of the 12 teams to be invited, and they were widely viewed as the least likely contender. So when the games began, no one expected much. But this is an underdog story, and you can probably guess what happens next.
Carter's has your family covered for every summer first. For steps, for swim lesson, or for sleepover. Our clothes help kids and parents shine, thanks to comfy design and easy dressing details. Visit Carter's.com to shop the latest styles or find a Carter's store near you.
It's America's 250th birthday, and I'm going to shop the furniture America's waited 250 years for at Bob's Discount Furniture. At Bob's, they've got ultra-comfy power reclining sofas with genuine leather seats, stylish dining sets with convenient lift-top storage, best-selling bedrooms with over 700 five-star reviews, and a feature-packed pop-up sleeper sofa with built-in shelving, charging, storage, and those signature Bob-opedic seats. So, stop in or shop online at Bob's Discount Furniture, where America shops for furniture.
CCNY had made it to the NIT tournament, but barely. No one expected them to make it past the first round. Their opening game was against the defending NIT champions, the University of San Francisco. But to everyone's surprise, CCNY blew past their opponent and made it to the next round. 2 days later, they were back on the court. CCNY fans were thrilled, but also anxious. Waiting for them was one of the best teams in the country, the powerhouse of college basketball, the University of Kentucky.
Kentucky was overwhelmingly favored. Kentucky was to college basketball what the New York Yankees were to Major League Baseball. They were the team who was always favored. They were building a huge stadium. They traveled by jetliner, which was unheard of in those days.
CCNY, on the other hand, was a tuition-free college. They didn't have fancy training facilities or huge travel budgets. But the differences between the two schools went even deeper.
Kentucky represented the Old South. It represented sort of everything that City College was not. The University of Kentucky had not a single African American among its thousands of undergraduates. There would not be a Black player on the University of Kentucky Wildcats for another 20 years.
The Kentucky coach had made his views on integration clear. He once said, "If the good Lord had intended Black boys and white boys to play together, he wouldn't have painted them different colors." Now the coach was facing a team that embodied everything he opposed, a lineup made up entirely of Black and Jewish players.
It was a clash, not just of basketball teams, but of value systems in a sense. And so that was sort of the stage that was set for this game.
If this were a sports movie, CCNY would start out behind and come storming back in the fourth quarter for the win. But that's not what happened. 10 minutes in, the score was 28-9, CCNY in the lead. By halftime, CCNY led 45-20. With 10 minutes left, the Beavers were up by 30. By the final buzzer, CCNY had won in a blowout. It was the Kentucky coach's worst defeat ever. So devastating that the state legislature actually considered lowering the flag to half-mast. For CCNY's players, that victory over Kentucky would become one of the most unforgettable games of their lives.
The day after the victory, Nat Holman brought them to Broadway to celebrate. And apparently before the show started, a voice came over the PA system to let the audience know that the City College team was in the audience. And apparently the entire theater stood and cheered for their team. One of the players told me later that he felt that at that moment they all could have run for president and won. So they were really the toast of the town.
With the Kentucky victory behind them, City College cruised through the rest of the tournament. In the championship game, the Beavers, ranked 27th in the nation, faced off against Bradley University, ranked number one. On paper, it shouldn't have been close, but CCNY flipped the odds, and for the first time in school history, they brought home the NIT title.
The big story in basketball was written in capital letters by the Beavers of City College. The speedy, sharpshooting Cagers from New York sent the blood pressure of their fans soaring as they swept to victory over the top teams of the nation.
CCNY had done the unimaginable. Now the question was, could they do the impossible? No team had ever won both the NIT and NCAA tournaments in the same year. And for CCNY, it didn't look promising. But fresh off their NIT victory, the City College Beavers kept rolling. They beat Ohio State, then NC State, and suddenly the underdogs were back in Madison Square Garden, facing Bradley once again for the national title. This brings us back to the moment when Jackie Robinson appeared at the locker room. Matthew writes about Jackie Robinson's visit in the City game, saying, quote, "He spoke only for a couple of minutes, and in that time, he never mentioned race. Yet the idea of racial integration seemed to underline everything he said." In other words, there was more at stake that night than just a basketball title.
New York City College, already victor over Bradley's Braves in the invitation tourney, takes them on again in the NCAA Finals. City jumps into the lead as Big Ed Roman sinks one from the corner.
The game came down to the wire. With seconds remaining, CCNY was leading by just 2 points. But they held their lead. When the buzzer sounded, the Beavers had done it. The final score was 71-68.
The Beavers won the National Invitation Tournament to hit a jackpot unprecedented in basketball. 1950 will long be remembered by Coach Nat Holman and his eager Beavers from CCNY.
As the New York Times put it, the Beavers were out of basketball worlds to conquer. The Associated Press called it one of the most amazing sagas in college basketball. And in the days after the championship, Coach Nat Holman appeared on the Ed Sullivan Show to a standing ovation.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. We have a big show lined up for you tonight.
They represented all of the qualities that New York wanted to believe about itself. Diversity, the triumph of the immigrants, civic virtue. One of the students said to me later about the importance of this championship. He said, "It's not that they did it for us. It's that they were us and they did it." There's a difference.
The mayor of New York called them our athletes, the city's own champions. And for the next 10 months, the Beavers really were the pride of New York.
They were absolute heroes. Classes were canceled at the school for the first time in the history of the school. They received the key to the city from the mayor at City Hall. There was a ticker tape parade. They were heroes, and that, of course, only made their subsequent fall all the greater.
Instacart makes grocery shopping easier, and just because you're not doing the shopping yourself doesn't mean you don't care how it's done. With Instacart Shopper Notes, you can get particular about what you want right in the app, like rotisserie chicken that's extra crispy, cheddar that's sharp as your skates, and lettuce you'd actually pick yourself. Just leave a note for your shopper so they can get it right for you without having to ask. That way, you can get groceries just how you like. Download the Instacart app and shop today.
Are you really buying a car online on AutoTrader right now?
Really? I can get super specific with dealer listings and see cars based on my budget.
Mom!
you can really have it delivered.
Or pick it up.
Mommy, look!
I think your kid is walking up the slide.
Really?
Auto Trader. Buy your car online. Really?
In the 1950s, New York City wasn't just the capital of college basketball. It was also the capital of bookmaking, organized underground sports betting.
Bookmaking was a major business in New York City at that time. It was illegal, of course, but having said that, there were thousands of bookmakers in the city of New York at that time.
Before the 1940s, sports betting was simple. You just picked a winner. But that made games between uneven teams pretty dull. There's not much fun in betting on a team that's almost certain to lose. Then a Chicago bookmaker changed everything. He introduced a new system, the point spread. Now instead of betting on who would win, gamblers could bet on whether the favorite team would win by more or less than a certain number of points.
So that allowed for a lot more betting than there would have been in a game in which one team was obviously going to win against the other team.
This innovation transformed sports betting from a niche pastime into a mass market obsession.
It was so widespread. I mean, millions of dollars were being wagered on college basketball at the Garden. Many of the bets were made from inside the Garden itself, from the bank of telephone booths that were right there in the lobby, filled with gamblers.
People in the stands who'd place bets didn't even bother to hide it. In the final moments of games, when the outcome was virtually decided, you could still hear fans chanting for players to miss a free throw.
And people who were not in the know were constantly being confused by this. Why are people getting in such an uproar about apparently meaningless foul shots?
The point spread didn't just attract more sports bets. It also drew in mobsters looking to fix games, or in other words, control the outcome. These mobsters had always been around, but before the point spread, they had to bribe players to lose games outright. A hard sell, no matter the amount of money. With the point spread, though, everything changed. Players didn't have to throw games anymore. They just had to win by a little less than predicted.
They were just trying to come in under the spread. So if they were favored to win by 8, they were going to try to win by fewer than 8 points.
For any of this to happen, the fixers first had to form relationships with the players. And that's exactly what they did with our beloved Beavers. It all started in the Catskill Mountains, a summer resort area about 2 hours north of New York City. At the time, the Catskills were a favorite getaway for the city's Jewish families who were excluded from other resort areas.
We're gonna hitchhike up to the Catskills. We know the highway, Route 17.
It was an extremely popular vacation resort because this was pre-air conditioning and so forth. And so people would go up to the mountains to get away from the heat and the smell and whatever of the city. So there were just hundreds of resorts.
To keep guests entertained, these resorts organized all kinds of activities, including basketball. Eventually, resorts formed their own basketball teams. And on Friday nights, they'd square off against one another, drawing big crowds. The games became so popular that hotels began recruiting top college players to join their teams.
Now, the NCAA rules forbid the hotels from hiring them to play basketball because they had to keep their amateur status in order to play college ball. So what the hotels would do would be that they would hire them as a waiter, or they would hire them as a busboy, or they would hire them as a lifeguard. But in point of fact, the reason why they were being chosen was because they were basketball players.
In the summer of 1950, the Catskill resorts had their eyes on CCNY players, the hottest commodity in town, fresh off their Grand Slam victory. Every resort wanted them on its roster, and so did the fixers. Betting on these resort games had become big business with real money at stake. So it's no surprise that fixers saw an opportunity to bribe players to control the outcome.
And that was where a lot of these basketball players learned how to control the score of a game. Not to win or lose intentionally, but to control the score. And in point of fact, you can really say that the point-shaving scandal was born in the Catskill Mountains.
when summer ended and the basketball season began, the Fixers followed the players back to the city, back to Madison Square Garden. Same proposition, but even more money to be made. Throughout the 1950-51 season, several CCNY players accepted bribes in exchange for point shaving. The problem was, once the game started, they weren't very good at it.
They ended up losing all of the games in which they were shaving points, unintentionally losing. But there was just the way that they played was a team game. It was very dependent on timing and rhythm and motion. And under these kinds of circumstances, it just seemed that the whole machine went haywire.
During these games, CCNY players shot air balls, threw passes into the crowd, and looked inexplicably sloppy. People started to suspect something was wrong. They just didn't know what.
And that leads to the ultimate question of, did the coach know? Nat Holman was somebody who had grown up playing basketball. He had watched thousands of games of basketball in his life. He claims that he did not know that this was going on, that he had absolutely no suspicion about it whatsoever. I can't say this for sure, but the weight of the evidence leads me to believe that he must have at least suspected that this was going on. But it was in his interest and the interest of the other coaches of the other teams not to look too closely.
But others were watching closely. Unbeknownst to the players, a massive investigation into point shaving was already underway. The Manhattan district attorney was unraveling a deep web of corruption, one that didn't just involve the Fixers, but also the cops who accepted money from the Fixers to look the other way.
On Fridays, New York City police officers and detectives would come in literally to get their envelopes filled with cash. And cops were, you know, making their mortgage payments and planning vacations, et cetera, based on the money that they were getting. That was the level of corruption that we were talking about.
On February 17th, 1951, CCNY players boarded a train from Philadelphia to New York after a game against Temple University. They didn't know it yet, but detectives from the Manhattan District Attorney's Office were also on board. The detectives quietly approached Coach Nat Holman and told him their plan. The moment the train crossed into New York's jurisdiction, they'd arrest three of the players. Holman didn't stand in their way. He told the detectives, "I have no sympathy for them if they're guilty." Around 2 a.m., the train pulled into Penn Station. Three players, handcuffed, were led quietly off the platform. By the time the sun came up, City College students had heard the news. Their heroes had taken bribes from the mob. None of the point shaving had happened during the championship run, but that didn't matter. The scandal tainted everything. One student reporter called it betrayal at a biblical level.
One of the students said to me that he did not experience that sense of collective grief again until the assassination of President Kennedy. That's the level of shock and grief and mourning that was going on the City College campus.
And the story didn't stay contained to campus. It spread fast through New York and across the country.
They were arrested on Sunday morning, and by Monday morning, they had become villains on the front page of all of the tabloid newspapers in New York.
It was being described as the most devastating sports corruption story since the Black Sox threw the 1919 World Series. Matthew says that in the hundreds of newspaper stories he read from that period, the narrative was the same. Players were immoral crooks, willing to sell out their team, their school, even their city for a quick buck. But Matthew doesn't see the players as villains. He believes the reality is more complicated.
None of them were doing it simply to get rich. For one of the guys that I wrote about, Eddie Roman, he wanted to give it later to his parents so they could pay off the mortgage on their house. Another guy who I wrote about extensively in the book, a guy named Floyd Lane, really didn't want to take the money. He said no three times before he finally agreed to do it. And he only agreed to do it when he realized that all of the other guys on the team were doing it.
By the time Floyd Lane was arrested, he'd spent just $110 out of the nearly $3,000 he'd been given. He used it to buy a washing machine for his mom. She was a domestic servant who'd spent her life washing other people's clothes.
It would be very easy for us, looking at the headlines in the newspapers, to say, oh, I wouldn't have done that. I'm a good person. I'm a moral person. I would not have accepted the money. And perhaps that's true. But if you were one of these players and someone offered you more money than you had ever seen before, not to lose a game, but simply to change the score of a game, and you saw that your parents were fretting every night at the kitchen table because they were afraid they were going to get thrown out of their house, and you knew that everyone in the arena that night was making money that night except for you, and they were making that money because of your labor, none of this would have been possible if not for your talents.
Regardless, it was the players who paid the price. In the end, seven CCNY players were charged with fixing games. One of them spent 6 months behind bars. All of their basketball careers were over. None of them would play again. And they weren't the only players caught up in the scandal. By the end of 1951, the DA had charged over 30 players from seven different schools. Among the schools were four of New York's five major basketball programs. Only one emerged untouched, St. John's University, an Irish Catholic school in Queens.
It was widely believed to be the case among everyone with whom I spoke that St. John's had been equally involved in the point shaving and yet had been protected from being involved in this scandal by the New York City Police Department, which was overwhelmingly Irish Catholic, overwhelmingly fans of St. John's, where the police commissioner was actually best friends with the coach of St. John's, sat behind them on the bench, and was referred to in the papers as St. John's number one fan. And to this day, St. John's University is the only one of those programs that still maintains a top-ranked Division I basketball program.
At the other New York schools, the damage was irreparable. Their basketball programs never recovered, and New York City itself lost its status as the capital of college basketball.
Because what happened in the wake of the scandal was that the former big-time programs like City College, like NYU, like Long Island University, canceled their programs or certainly downgraded them so that they were no longer playing in Madison Square Garden. They were no longer attracting gamblers and so forth. So you no longer had any of those big time programs, and the local players who at one time would have gone to City College or to St. John's ended up going down to North Carolina. And that was really the birth of big time basketball in North Carolina.
The consequences were now painfully clear. Careers destroyed, programs dismantled, reputations ruined. The CCNY players would live with the stigma the rest of their lives. But for others, the lessons apparently didn't resonate. Just 10 years later, there was another massive point shaving scandal. And Matthew says maybe that's not so surprising, not in a system where everyone profits except the players.
You just can't have a situation in which there's millions of dollars flowing through the game, and these kids, most of whom are coming from poor backgrounds, are getting none of it. That condition is absolutely ripe for people taking money on the side.
Back then, no one was talking about amateurism or just how uneven the system was for the players. In the years following the point shaving scandal, the 1950 Beavers were remembered primarily for their mistakes and not their achievements. But over time, the perception of them began to shift. In 1994, they were inducted into the New York City Basketball Hall of Fame, the first college team ever honored there. 15 years later, a group of sports writers and coaches named their double championship run the greatest college basketball moment in Madison Square Garden history. And here's the thing about their achievement. It can never be repeated. Soon after the scandal, the NCAA ruled that teams had to choose between their tournament and the NIT. You couldn't play in both. That new rule sealed City College's place in history forever. The 1950 Beavers remained the only team to win both tournaments in a single season. And that will always be true. If you've got a story idea, we would love to hear about it. Send us an email at campusfilespod@gmail.com. And if you're loving this podcast, be sure to click follow on your favorite podcast app so you never miss an episode. While you're there, leave us a review and a 5-star rating. Campus Files is an Odyssey original podcast hosted by Margot Gray and Ian Mont. Our executive producers are Leah Rees-Dennis and Lloyd Lockridge. Campus Files is produced by Ian Mont and Margot Gray. Sound design and engineering by Andy Jaskowitz and Zach Clark. Legal support by Laura Berman and Melissa Jean. Original music by Davey Sumner. Special thanks to Maura Curran, Josephina Francis, Hilary Schuff, Eric Donnelly, Kate Hutchison-Rose, Sean Cherry, Kurt Courtney, and Lauren Vieira.